why eating your fruits and veggies is so important.
What we're now learning is that when we eat plants that are rich in phytonutrients, we get protection from our own threat, both externally, like the same UV light, which can harm plants, but also from cancer, cardiovascular disease, and inflammation, and even diabetes and obesity.
But we've bred out the nutrients from many plants we eat. Investigative journalist Joe Robinson tells us how that happened and how to choose the most nutritious plant foods and varieties in her book, Eating on the Wild Side. And choosing between two worlds, nature and civilization, to live the good life.
So I started noticing all these patterns, like one world is free, and the other is everything's for sale. And it seemed wise at a point in my life to, you know, dock my boat to the one that's living, the one that has knowledge I can intuit, knowledge that can keep me alive, actually.
That's maker and author Wendy Jehanara Tremaine talking about her book, The Good Life Lab, Radical Experiments and Hands-on Living. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We've all heard that an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But as the apples we eat get sweeter and less tart, we're losing some of that healthy protection. In fact, ever since humans began growing their own food, we've tried to make fruits and vegetables sweeter and milder. But in the process, we've been breeding out the healthiest nutrients, vitamins and minerals contained in wild plants, but lacking or less available in domesticated ones. Industrial agriculture has accelerated the process, breeding produce for durability rather than nutrition, and depleting soils of natural nutrients. What we've lost are the phytonutrients that protect us from such ills as cancer and diabetes. But don't despair, says my guest Joe Robinson. There are still plenty of vegetables and fruits that remain nutrition powerhouses and varieties that are more healthful than others. Granny Smith apples over Honeycrisp, for example, or scallions instead of Vidalia onions. And there are ways of preparing and storing food that preserve their nutrients optimally. All this and more is in Robinson's book, Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. Joe Robinson is also the author of Pasture Perfect and Why Grass-Fed is Best, as well as several other books. Joe Robinson, welcome to Writer's Voice. I just love this book, Eating on the Wild Side. I pride myself as somebody who knows a lot about nutrition, but boy, there was a whole lot of information here that was completely new to me. Although I did know that we have in our food supply, even if we're eating, you know, fruits and vegetables, we have had a dramatic loss of what are called phytonutrients. Tell us first, what are phytonutrients, and then tell us why we've lost so many of them in our food.
Phytonutrients is a more popular term for a scientific term called polyphenols. And these are compounds that plants produce primarily to protect themselves from external threats, things like insects and disease, drought, too much UV light. So they're constantly producing this botanical arsenal. And these are phytonutrients. What we're now learning is that when we eat plants that are rich in phytonutrients, we get protection from our own threats, both externally, like the same UV light, which can harm plants, but also from cancer, cardiovascular disease, and inflammation, and even diabetes and obesity. And why have we lost so many of them? It's been a long process. Many people think that we've been eroding the food quality of our diet only in the last 50 or 100 years, but it started with the very first gardens 10,000 to 12,000 years ago. And the reason that we started breeding plants that were lower in phytonutrients, many of them that are the most potent, the most beneficial for our health, have a sour, astringent, or bitter taste. And so, you know, long ago, before we knew there was such a thing as antioxidants, phytonutrients, or even vitamins, we decided that we liked food that tasted sweeter and less bitter. And so we just logically made these choices. I mean, we've always selected food by taste. We do now, and we did then. It's just back then, the very first farmers had no idea what they were doing in terms of the health benefits of the food they were creating.
Could you give us some examples of some foods that were naturally very, very high in phytonutrients, but now have lost them? I mean, many of these are the foods that we're being told to eat because they have so many phytonutrients.
I would say, with very few exceptions, all wild plants, the plants that we consumed before we were farmers, are much higher in phytonutrients than any of the ones that we've bred. And sometimes the difference is very dramatic. There's wild apples, for example, that have 400 times more phytonutrients than some of the most popular apples that we eat today. It's a staggering difference. More commonly, the wild plants pre-agriculture might have 2 to 50 times more. Other examples would be wild tomatoes, which have, you know, about 30 times more of a phytonutrient called lycopene, which is linked with a lower risk of stroke and heart attack than the ones that we grow. Potatoes that grew wild and still grow wild in the Andes might have 25 times more phytonutrients than the ones in our stores. Wild greens have, you know, 2 to 20 times more phytonutrients. It's pretty much across the board.
In your book, Eating on the Wild Side, you don't really stop with saying we've lost with so many phytonutrients. There's actually a lot that you point out that we can do in order to eat more on the wild side, where we can get closer to the kind of phytonutrients that used to be in our food. First of all, you say that different varieties of different fruits and vegetables actually have differing levels of phytonutrients. You just mentioned the apple. Let's take that first. What are some varieties of apples that are better for you, and which are ones that are not so good?
The Granny Smith apple is often the most nutritious apple in the store, and it has 13 times more phytonutrients overall than a newly released apple called Ginger Gold, and 3 or 4 times more than Golden Delicious, which is our most popular apple in the United States and also now in the world. So this is, you know, a significant difference. Other high ones that are high would include the Red Delicious, which has fallen out of favor, Fuji Honeycrisp, as long as you eat the skin, and Gala and Braeburn are up there, higher than others. The ones that are especially low are the Pink Lady, the Ginger Gold, L-Star, Empire, and the Golden Delicious. Those are ones that if you want to have more health benefits, you would avoid these and choose ones that are richer in phytonutrients.
You also talk about apple, even of the same variety, some apples are going to have more phytonutrients than others. What determines that? I mean, let's say you have Granny Smith is a green apple, but take a red variety that's pretty good. What do you want to look for when you either pick one off the tree or take one out of the supermarket bin?
In the years that I spent researching this book, one of the most meaningful things I learned is that plants, when they're stressed, they're going to produce more of this botanical arsenal, more phytonutrients. And when it comes to apples, one of the biggest stressors is going to be sunlight. So an apple that's in the sun, as opposed to one that's in the shade, might have 2 or 3 times more phytonutrients than ones that haven't had to protect themselves against UV light. And if it's a red variety, then they're going to be red on all sides, the ones, you know, that are more stressed and therefore better for us. And the ones that are more green or yellow didn't have to protect themselves against light, and they're less protective for us. So it's like the plant's protection becomes our protection.
And then once we take the apple home, storage is another factor that you use throughout this book to talk about preserving phytonutrients. Again, let's take the apple. What's the best way to store it?
I was surprised to learn that you want to immediately put it in the refrigerator and in the crisper drawer, set on, if you can change the humidity, set it on high humidity, that it will last 10 times longer in the refrigerator than on your counter. And I think we've all noticed that apples on the counter get, you know, a little bit withered looking and they're not as flavorful, kind of mushy. But I was surprised to learn that they'll last 10 times longer if we keep them humid and cold.
And what if we want to do something to preserve them? What might be the best way to preserve an apple? I mean, you know, we can get dried apple slices. Is that going to, you know, get rid of the phytonutrients, or will it preserve it, or is there some other preserved way to keep them?
Almost all dried apples are peeled before they're dried, and the peel is the has the most dense concentration of phytonutrients. So just even before they dry it, you're losing a lot of nutrients, and the drying itself can reduce the phytonutrient content by about half. If you want to preserve it, a better way to do it would be to keep it, don't peel it, and to slice it and freeze it and put a little, actually some sugar and cinnamon on it will keep more phytonutrients intact than if you don't add those things.
That sounds yummy.
Yeah, we've been taught that, well, let's not put sugar on things, but when you're freezing things, a little dusting of sugar is a healthful thing to do.
Why is that?
Because that, especially if it's cinnamon sugar, cinnamon is a very potent antioxidant and is going to be protecting the apple from the oxygen in the bag that wants to oxidize it, and oxidation will get rid of these phytonutrients. But the sugar itself kind of makes a coating on the apple that protects, is another way to insulate it from the oxygen. So basically you want to keep it away from being oxidized, because as soon as something starts to be oxidized, any antioxidants, phytonutrients that are in there are used up protecting that apple. We find other ways to protect the apple so that the phytonutrients are there for us.
Other ways?
Other ways to preserve them? Mm-hmm. Actually, applesauce is an excellent way, because especially if you make applesauce and keep the skins on while you're cooking it and you remove the skins later, just you can use a food mill to get rid of the skins if you don't want them in the applesauce. Applesauce is, next to apples, it's the most nutritious form, you know, next to fresh apples. So making more applesauce, which of course we used to do 50 years ago and much more than we do now. And in the store, buying apple juice, applesauce rather than apple juice might give you 25 times more of these phytonutrients. So applesauce is something we need to bring back, make it more, you know, add it to our diet and, you know, more often, and make it ourselves.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jo Robinson about her book, Eating on the Wild Side. Well, this is a wonderful book. And in fact, I do make my own applesauce. I found that it's an incredibly easy thing to do. And it sure beats even store-bought, even organic store-bought. But another thing you do, I was surprised to find out that some things are actually more nutritious once you cook them. Talk about blueberries first.
All berries, but blueberries in particular, the anthocyanins, what the most important phytonutrient in many berries, becomes more concentrated and available when you cook it. And I'm not saying you shouldn't eat raw berries, because they're excellent for you, and we need to eat far more. I think on average we eat 1 tablespoon of berries a week. That's just a paltry amount. We should be having 1/2 cup to 1 cup a day. So, yeah, eat a lot of raw berries, but if you're going to make it into a cobbler or a cake or muffins, you're going to get even more than if they were raw. So we want to eat them cooked and raw.
And tell us about some other berries that you like.
Cranberries are very high in anthocyanins and other phytonutrients, and they also have they can protect against bacteria. We need to eat them more than just at Thanksgiving and Christmas, which we do in this country, and buy them on sale, you know, when they are on sale during the holidays, and freeze them ourselves so that we always can have some on hand and make side dishes out of them. They're terrific accompaniments to any kind of a meat dish. That nice tart tang will just make a really clean taste with the meat. So I would say we need to eat far more cranberries than we do.
And I should say, tell our listeners that you actually give a whole lot of wonderful recipes in this book, Eating on the Wild Side, as well as lists of the best varieties to buy, to find in farmers markets, or even to grow yourself. So it's a very useful that way. But, you know, with cranberries as well as other fruits like blueberries, one thing I'm concerned about are pesticides. And it's awfully hard to find organic cranberries, although I think organic blueberries are a little bit more available. What are your thoughts on the pesticide issue?
For me, the bottom line is we should be eating organic food to the extent that we can afford it. And when you think of food as medicine, not just as food, and think about how much money you might be spending on medications, we need to realize that we ought to be spending more on food than we are spending. We're spending less on food than we have for decades. And, you know, that it's really to our detriment and to the detriment of the planet and to farm workers. So I say, for me, organic is the bottom line, and the only time I won't buy organic is if it's very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend, to the degree that we all can, is to purchase organic food, and it's not only good for our health, but for all these other factors as well. It just has a multitude of benefits, and, you know, the one, of course, is going to keep us from ingesting all these pesticides, which is so important for our health.
Right. So now we're coming into tomato season here on the East Coast. That's the other big fruit that people like to eat. Lycopene, tell us about lycopene a little bit. And something about the history of the tomato. You mentioned wild tomatoes before. But even just in the last, even 100 years ago, tomatoes had more lycopene than they do now.
Well, not necessarily. Some did and some didn't. It's kind of a correction we need to make in our thinking about heirloom fruits and vegetables. The common thinking right now is that if our great-grandparents raised it or our grandparents raised it, it's just simply going to be more healthful. That's not always the case. We have some heirloom varieties that are 1,000 years old, really ancient heirlooms, that are not nearly as nutritious as some varieties that have been released in the last 10 years. What really matters is the genetics of the individual plant and, you know, its chemistry. So we need to, unfortunately, we need to be looking at these lists that we now have, which tell us which variety, sometimes it's heirloom, sometimes it's modern, which is better for us, and it's not just the more ancient ones that are better. And in terms of tomatoes, there's a heirloom tomato called a Donna, which is tasty and many people like it, but the tomatoes that you might get at the corner grocery store are better for you. It's startling, really, that we can't go by the date of creation. We need to go by the individual chemistry. And this is something we've only known for the last 15 or 20 years. That's why so much in my book is new, because I've been going into very recent scientific journals and pulling out studies that I think are very important for consumers, that the information has not even been released yet. And it's this chemical analysis which is giving us our first really good look and how we've been reading nutrients out of our food for 400 generations. It's a startling new way of thinking about fruits and vegetables.
And yet you say that we can actually use some indicators like size to choose a healthier tomato, size and color.
Yeah, and it's not true for all fruits and vegetables, but it's certainly true for tomatoes that the smaller the tomato, the better it is for us. So a cherry tomato is better for you than a slicing tomato, and a slicing tomato is better for you than one of these large plate-covering beefsteak tomatoes. And the best ones of all are the tiny cherry tomatoes. Some are called grape tomatoes, and there's this new variety out now called the currant tomatoes, and they're the best of all. And they're not only higher in lycopene, which is the phytonutrient that is the most important one in tomatoes, but they're have a more concentrated tomato flavor, and they're sweeter. This is a great example of sometimes something which is the best tasting is also the best for you.
We're talking with Jo Robinson about her book, Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. Now, let's talk a little bit about the greens, because we know how important they are. But the storage of greens is also really important. Let's take the example of lettuce, and actually there are different varieties there, too, that some are better than others. I mean, I think probably most of us know that iceberg aren't that great for you, but tell us what are the good ones, and what are the characteristics we need to look for to choose the good varieties?
Right, and once again, that principle of, you know, if a plant has to protect itself more by creating more phytonutrients, then it's better for us. Well, think about the iceberg lettuce for a minute. The leaves are tightly wrapped, and so all of those leaves on the inside are completely shielded from UV light, and they don't have to produce phytonutrients. So when we eat them, we don't get very much either. So I was shocked to find out that the leaves on the inside of iceberg lettuce, and that's like 90% of them, have only 1% of the antioxidants as those darker green ones on the outside. So, like I say, location, location, location. So let's compare the iceberg with all those tightly wrapped leaves with loose-leaf lettuce that does not wrap around itself. All of the leaves are spread out to the sun, and all of them have to be defending themselves against UV light. And because of that, they're much richer in phytonutrients. And so the order of benefits is the most nutritious lettuce in the store is a loose-leaf red lettuce. Next, a loose-leaf dark green lettuce with red or brown-tinged leaves. Dark green loose-leaf lettuce comes next. Light-colored loose-leaf lettuce. And then finally, the icebergs are at the very bottom. So we can just go into the store, look around. If it's a loose-leaf lettuce and if this has any kind of a reddish color to it, that's the one to bring home. That's the one that is really going to be most beneficial for our health.
And you also say that we can prepare salads in a way to improve the bioavailability of their phytonutrients, to get scientific here. You say we need fat.
Yes, many of the nutrients that are important for our health must be coated in a fat. It's called a micelle, this fatty membrane, in order for us to digest it. So when we eat a salad without any kind of dressing or with a non-fat dressing, we only get about a third of these important fat-soluble nutrients than if we have some fat along with it. So that era of, you know, just sprinkling a little bit of vinegar on our salad because we didn't want to eat any fat, that was not a good thing to do in terms of our overall health. And I was charmed to find out that olive oil will make the nutrients in lettuce about 5 times more easy to absorb. So an extra virgin olive oil dressing is the thing to put on your salad.
That's great. Now, a lot of people are going to turn their noses up at some of the most healthiest greens. The crucifers, you talk about broccoli. What is that one that everybody hates?
Brussels sprouts?
Yeah. Brussels sprouts, which I used to hate, but now I actually love them. Some people you say are genetically predisposed to be, you know, super sensitive to the bitterness in these greens. And children also are often, I think of my granddaughter who doesn't like kale, but she'll tolerate lettuce. What are some things that we can do to make these greens, these super healthy greens, more palatable?
The secret with the colt cabbage family, and many of them are bitter, and the more bitter they are, Brussels sprouts, for example, the most bitter, are the best for us, is to cook them very briefly. There's a kind of a five-minute rule. If you can cook and ideally steam something in the cabbage family for 5 minutes or less, it's not going to develop as much bitterness. It's going to be sweeter, and the we're going to have maximum intake of phytonutrients. So that's the first thing, is steam it for 5 minutes or less, and it will be really surprisingly sweet. I know many good cooks know this already, simply by trial and error, and great chefs know this, that you'll find that many of the greens that they prepare are very lightly steamed because they taste so much better, and now we know they're also better for us.
Now, you say you've been researching this book for a long time, Joe Robinson. What were some of the biggest challenges that you found?
The biggest challenge has been finding people who have researched the differences between among varieties of the same fruit or vegetable. I've gone through 6,000 studies plus, and you know, every day while I was actively researching this book, I would just look for, you know, I'd have certain search terms. For example, peach, polyphenol, variety. I just put those words in there. And, you know, I just would often come up without any studies that I could draw on because people were not doing the research. Thankfully, more and more people, now that we know the differences between varieties, are starting to do this testing. And interestingly, more people in other countries than in the United States, we're behind the times when it comes to testing the phytonutrients in the varieties that we eat and in breeding plants specifically to have more phytonutrients. That's not the way we operate. You know, we're so much of an industrial agricultural society where we're looking at breeding things which maintain the appearance of freshness for weeks, even though they've been in a warehouse, and things that are very large and ripen all at once, so you only have to send that harvester through the field once and firm enough to ship. So we're basically tailoring our fruits and vegetables to meet the industrial model, then to tailor them to enhance our health. Dramatically that way in this country. You know, that one of the main reasons I wrote my book is because I want to turn that around. I want to help turn that around. We need to be seeing the food that we eat as an instrument for our health before we look at it as, you know, a commodity that we want maximum volume and lowest cost.
Well, your book is a wonderful guide to that and is chock full of information. I want to thank you so much, Joe Robinson. Your book is Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Go to writersvoice.net for an excerpt from Joe Robinson's Eating on the Wild Side. Next up, The Good Life, updated. Stay tuned after the break.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. August 20th was Earth Overshoot Day. The day in each year, according to the Global Footprint Network, our demands on the planet's natural resources exceeded its capacity. In the first 8 months of 2013, we've already exhausted the natural resources that should last all year. We're now dipping into resources we can't afford to use. My guest, Wendy Jehanara Tremaine, has opted out of the overshoot lifestyle. With her partner, Mikey Sklar, she lives off the grid in a used trailer they picked up for a song on a formerly barren RV park in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Repurposing trash and making much of what they need, the couple live well on about $20,000 a year. It wasn't always this way. Once upon a time, the two were career professionals in New York City, making six-figure incomes. But something was missing. The satisfaction, creativity, and pleasure of living in harmony with nature and within nature's boundaries. Tremaine and Sklar are part of a burgeoning maker movement that uses tech shops, fab labs, and hacker spaces to invent and make what they need. Before coming out with the Good Life Lab, Wendy Jehanara Tremaine was best known for founding the clothing and design exchange Swaparamarama. Well, Wendy Jehanara Tremaine, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me, Francesca.
Well, your book, The Good Life Lab, Radical Experiments in Hands-on Living, was right up my alley. I'm already and have for a long time been doing some of the things you do in the book, like make my own yogurt. I just started making kombucha. But it added a wealth of information that, you know, I'm still savoring. The title is a reference to an earlier book by Helen and Scott Nearing, Living the Good Life.
That's correct. I'm a big fan of Helen Nearing in particular. And when I sat down to write my book, I reread her book because I felt we had a lot in common, in particular leaving the city during unstable economic times. But also Helen was kind of philosophical, and I felt that we had that in common as well. In fact, in the book, a couple of times I quote the Indian mystic Krishnamurti, and I believe Helen even dated Krishnamurti.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so her journey was in 1954, but it's interesting to note how similar some of the problems in the world are, how similar things remain.
So now you went from New York, where you are in marketing, you and your husband, your partner, to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. That's quite a leap. How did you make that leap?
Well, I guess the first part of the leap was just deciding to leave New York. And that was kind of hard because we both had career jobs like most people in New York do. And, you know, often those are jobs you work really hard to get. So there's that turn of realization that this isn't really serving us. But I think once we made that decision, because we both wanted to be makers of things and we had known that in New York, we would run off on weekends and try to learn to weld and squeeze in like time to develop skills, but quite unsuccessfully. Because we knew that, Truth or Consequences offered space. That was often the limitation. Even like, for example, if you learn to weld in a Brooklyn metal shop like we did, you can kind of tinker on little things, but you can't make anything big, and especially put anything big in your tiny New York apartment. So one of the reasons was space. The other was we had made a new commitment in our lives, which was not to be driven by money, not to have that be the lead. And when you do that and when you quit your job, one of the first things you have to do is leave New York and go somewhere much less expensive. So truth or consequences, it is really inexpensive, has a lot of natural resources, and then it's very beautiful. I think it's one of the last places remaining in our country where you can be a pioneer. It really does feel like the Wild West.
And talk a little bit more about that process that you went through. You have a chart in the book somewhere where you say we all live in two worlds. You contrast the two worlds. Tell us about those two worlds that you lay out there and how you made the transition from one to the other.
Mm. You know, I guess this is where me and Helen Meering link up, because for me, it's all about meaning, you know, and although the book is very much about stuff, I feel that that's just a part of the book, and without the meaning, we don't go anywhere. It's a trend, not a movement. So that chart is actually my favorite part of the book, because it looks at the two worlds, which, for lack of a better word, I described as modern civilization and nature. Those are the two. And I had started to notice throughout my childhood, even, that one of those worlds was alive and the other wasn't. That one of those worlds was sort of a sucker on the other. Everything that civilization makes comes from nature. But unlike nature, which is perfect and wasteless, civilization produces waste in that process and causes ultimately destruction to life, which is illogical because it runs on the fuel of us. It doesn't have life. So we go to work every day, and that's the fuel. So I started noticing all these patterns, like one world is free, the others, everything's for sale. And it seemed wise at a point in my life to, dock my boat to the one that's living, the one that has knowledge I can intuit, that I don't need to go to the university to learn, knowledge that can keep me alive, actually, not just out of jail, so to speak. Yeah, and I love to continue that exploration. I think any good contemplative question should last a lifetime and never be finished. So I continue to ask that question, what are the distinctions between nature and civilization?
And you talk about nature being wasteless in some way. That's what you've adopted by living in the waste stream. What does that mean?
I started off living in the waste stream and from nature as a sort of pledge. And really, by making that pledge, it gave me an opportunity to take a pit stop. Because I think most of us alive today have the unique conundrum, really, of being the problem and the solution. And it's paradoxical. So living in waste and from nature was a chance to push pause on being the problem, being the one who's consuming resources without control or knowledge of where they're coming from or how they're being processed and what their ultimate cost to life is. So I just lived out of waste. It's already made. It's guilt-free. And if I make mistakes learning to become a maker of things, it doesn't matter. It's on its way to landfill anyway. Even the home we bought in Truth or Consequences was a 40-year-old mobile home. Most people would call it trash. And the insurance company, my insurance company, valued it at $1,000. And this was such a gift because we looked at each other and knew this is how we'll learn to use power tools. We can't make it worth less. So, you know, we have this problem called waste, but we also are the beneficiaries of the largest surplus to exist on the earth ever. And that's a chance for us to learn to take back our skills. So that's how we used it.
These are two very connected themes. One is living in the waste stream, meaning using things that were headed for the landfill, but repurposing them or refurbishing them. And the other is making things yourself. These are kind of the two pillars of your book. So take us to your homestead in Truth or Consequences. Describe for our listeners, what are some of the structures that you have there that you have created out of the waste stream, and some of the skills that you needed to learn in order to do that?
So, well, like I mentioned, we started with that old mobile home, and that gave us basic power tools skills. And after that, we went to the waste stream again. We wanted some additional structures, and we found moderately dented shipping containers that, once dented, can't really be used on cargo, on ships to carry goods across the oceans. So they're obtainable in the waste stream. So we threw a couple of those down and explored the possibility of making them livable. And then, like any good project, learned that they're not so livable, not in our climate, because a hot metal box in the sun is rather uncomfortable to inhabit. So we turned them into sheds and a lab for my partner to work in and do electronics work. And then we got almost immediately overconfident, and we said, let's see what we can build from scratch. And that was interesting because the way we approached our materials was to ask what's close that doesn't require transportation, which is a carbon footprint, and what can be used to build a new building out of. And we found that our recycling center didn't recycle paper, though they did collect it. And paper is very insulative, and it was free, of course. It was in the waste stream. So we learned to return it to a pulp and use it to actually make buildings. We hybrided it with a technique called ferro cement, which uses rebar and some metal lath. And with that, we built a 4-ton, 300-foot privacy wall in front of our property, and then we built a 9-foot diameter dome, which is lovely. It looks earthen when finished. And then right now we have a partially built, we need to go home and finish, 20-foot diameter guest house with 2 rooms in it. And that was much more ambitious. So, but again, it started with the question and the pledge, really. And the more we stuck to our pledge, the better guided we were. So the pledge, again, was if it's not in nature or waste, then it's not of interest to us.
Hmm. And we are talking with Wendy Jehanara Tremaine about her book that is just filled with great advice, terrific ideas. It's called The Good Life Lab, Radical Experiments in Hands-on Living. So tell us more about this papercrete. How is it made, actually? What do you need to do to make it? What kind of materials do you need to make it?
So papercrete is like alternative building, right? So, you know, we've heard of straw bale and cob and some of these techniques, but papercrete never gets on the building inspector's list. You know, it's never approved. So one thing that one has to do to build with it is to get permission from a local building inspector. And the way that we did that was we actually started with a structural engineer who's like-minded. The benefit is for $50, that person, if they agree with your design, and ours did, will just put a stamp on it that actually relieves a local building inspector from all liability, which means they cannot stop you from building with it. So we put that, our plans then, on the state record, following another pledge we made to keep our skill and knowledge open to others. So that's now shared. But then to make it practical and functional, we had to build a mixer. So basically anything that can return paper to a pulp. In our case, we did a tow behind, meaning tow it behind a tow truck, mixer using a feed tank, so common materials, using a differential from a Ford 150, which is a truck that you can get in the dump, and some common parts, and constructed this large tow-behind mixer and started basically chopping phone books. And then from there, to make it pliable, you just have to find ways to get it right from that tank to your building. So there's pouring into slabs. You can make blocks. And then we used a trash pump, which is more typically used when your basement floods and you have to get all that sludge out. We used that to move it and pump it into our walls. And then lastly, we used some traditional mortar tools to spray it. So we really explored the full the full array of how to use paper.
That's amazing. Now, how did you learn how? I mean, it seems to me you must be engineers, but you don't, because you're creating tools. I mean, like using a differential from a truck. How did you learn how to do that?
So, well, the best ideas, right, like that mixer, we didn't invent the idea, but it's one of those weird ideas, like someone did it, and you hear rumor, and then you have to kind of find an example, maybe, or you just go for it, but you heard enough to get it, and then you try to recreate it. So that was the case there. But the other thing is, you know, it's really fun to make things, and we, you know, looking back, I can see that my job and Mikey's job really specialized us, and most do. That's the way our society is structured. You get very good at like a couple of things, and you're like a specialized expert. But when you walk away from that and take back all of your domestic life and everything you need to live, in no time you realize that you're very diverse in terms of your skills palette. And there's really no area that you can't innovate in. So I think the magic ingredient there is time and inspiration.
It certainly helps that you were a couple. Is this something that really takes more than one person, or do you think one person alone could do this?
Well, I think even us alone can't do it, you know, even though we sort of did do it. You know, there's always the limit of what you can do, and thank goodness for it, or we'd wind up, you know, too isolated. So many stages along the way, we called in friends and then dialed up the others who had built with these materials. We went out on road trips to visit them and talk with them. So, you know, if we're lucky, right, we can't do it all the way ourselves, and that's our prompt, that we're not meant to be alone, and we reconnect to the others. But, you know, I should say, Mikey and I are, you know, we were really set on making sure what we did was something that can be duplicated by others. So we could have done things that didn't fit that, but we chose to do things so that other couples like us could follow. Mikey and I are both 5'6". We're both about 135 pounds. Like, we're not big and strong, neither one of us. We're not specially talented. We're just anybody. And that was important.
So when you talk about going with others, being with others, you found like-minded people. There's a whole movement called the Maker Movement. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We've been on a book tour, so we've really been visiting the Maker Movement in person. We sort of came out of it in New York when it was just beginning, and then now, 7 years later, we're on tour visiting the Maker Fairs, which is actually a fair that came from O'Reilly Publishing, who began Make Magazine, and they host these fairs. It's a lovely movement because few movements have a very broad umbrella. So what I mean by that is you go to a maker fair or a maker house or a maker space, and you find every socioeconomic, you know, everyone on the socioeconomic scale. You find people of all ages, of all income levels, of all backgrounds, because what's a maker? Well, a maker is someone who cooks in the kitchen, who sews, who builds jet engines, who tinkers with electronics, who works with metal, who works with wood. There's no end. So it's such a great place for everybody to gather. So what we're seeing on our book tour is so exciting because we're also visiting tech shops, fab labs, hacker spaces, and they're basically, what they have in common is they're places where people can go and use tools that they might not otherwise have access to or be able to afford. And then what follows is skills. So not only the tools, but you go learn to use the tools, and then you start developing skill and within the context of being with others. So this is really exciting, and people are beginning to adapt this into the culture. We've also just started bumping into tool libraries where you can just borrow tools like a library book. But what's lovely is the spirit of making things, and people are starting to take making their own goods back into their lives. In some cities, we just came from Portland, for example, and when we left New York, this was just amping up. There's the whole artisanal culture coming back, so glass blowing and metalsmithing, and, you know, there's whole stores just selling mayonnaise, artisanal mayonnaise. And it's really exciting, but I also always put a butt on my excitement around that because it can so easily become trend, and it shouldn't, because there's meaning in it. So, you know, as makers of things, we get to make decisions better than corporations. Corporations have to choose the thing that is most profitable, not the thing that preserves life. Makers can make the choice that preserves life. Makers can give to the commons. We know we stand on the shoulders of others. No one can make anything alone. So we have an opportunity here, and we can't let that just become about stuff. So if we don't make it contemplative while we make this stuff, then we miss the point.
And you are also informed by some a spiritual tradition, a Sufism, is that right?
Yeah, along the way, I bumped into some Sufis, and they filled my pockets with knowledge and interesting ways to contemplate. which was so valuable, really. The Sufis have a long tradition of asking juicy, wonderful, contemplative questions, and then also a tradition of ways to return to nature, ways to remove the boundaries that separate us from nature. And when those boundaries come down, what becomes evident is, you know, we're not like this little life with a name, but we're the whole thing, that we have access to a source of knowledge, a living source of knowledge that we're not apart from, that we actually are a part of. So there's a lot of gifts in there that really helped me do everything.
And we are talking with Wendy Jehanara Tremaine about her book, The Good Life Lab, Radical Experiments in Hands-on Living. Back to the makers, when you were still living in Brooklyn, you started this this thing called Swaporama-rama, which I really love. I sewed for many, many years. So when I read about, I hadn't known about this before reading your book. I went online and I looked a little bit more about it. Tell us what Swaporama-rama was or is.
Yeah, so Swaporama-rama is a funny thing. So since this came right after the Sufi question, I'm going to share with you something I never tell anybody, but it's funny. So the night before I started Swaporama-rama, someone asked me to go to a kirtan, which I had not gone to before, and I went along, and it's a Hindu gathering where you sing. And one of the phrases most sung at a kirtan in repetition is Rama. So the next day when I started Swaporama-rama and I needed a name, I said, well, Swaporama. And then I added the second because I just came from a kirtan where I spent 10 hours repeating Rama. And I thought, well, this will be great because that's power, right? Ram is like this powerful force in the universe. So I brought that in and I thought it was kind of funny. So Swaporama-rama was meant to be a one-day project, an example, in the public space. I had been doing it at home in small form, and I thought, I'm going to do this as an art project just once. And basically, it's a clothing swap, so everyone just brings what they no longer need, they donate it, and that becomes the textile stuff that we use to repurpose. Then I invited, I think at that one, 10 or 15 local designers who come with a sewing machine and help people deconstruct and reconstruct those used clothes. And then we added in silk screeners so that with the swipe of a squeegee, we've made a garment new. And then a lot of artists. I mean, this was New York, so people were showing up in droves. You know, I want to teach how to turn a bra into a pocketbook, and I want to teach how to embed electronics into a T-shirt. So it grew in that fashion. And what was amazing was 500 people came to the first event. By the end of a year, my one-day art project had this impulse to grow. 20 cities by the end of that year heard about it, contacted me, and wanted to model it. So I realized this can actually solve problems and be more than a one-day model. And the only right thing that appeared for me to do was to put it in the commons and make it really accessible. And that's what I did. I formulated it into a copyable model, made it a nonprofit, shared it. And to this day, I've never promoted Swaporama-rama, and it's been in about 110 cities.
Wow. That's wonderful. So what has been maybe the biggest challenge for you in this different kind of life? I mean, has it all been easy sailing?
No, you know, I mean, I think the first 3 years, we bought a property that was such utter waste, you know, really like depressing, awful property, a parking lot virtually, not a single plant. I mean, there were like the first couple of years was pure work, really work, and work without like the physical inspiration each day, right, to make your heart lift, you know. Not that it maybe existed in town, but I didn't have it. So that, you know, that was hard in a way. I found it also motivating. But there was always this, like, excitement of creativity that led the way, you know, and overrode that. I think the real challenges have been learning to say no to good offers of work. So we left New York, and the phone, you know, starts to ring. People start to know who you are and what your skills are. Mikey was getting great offers. Big distractions would have taken us right off course. Great money. Me too. Big offers to write books, all sorts of things. And it's really hard to say no, especially when you don't have a job or an income. But to say yes is to actually miss the point and take yourself off your own commitment. So that was the hardest.
Wow. And you have been able to make some money. You have a website. You have a cottage industry. Mikey makes temperature controllers, and you make tinctures and some other things as well. But that's all integrated in what you do. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, it changes day to day. But basically, our formula was, you know, we had the benefit of coming from New York, so we left with a nest egg. We used that to establish ourselves in Truth or Consequences. And as that shrunk, right, and we learned to make what we used to buy more and more each year, it reached a point where we said, okay, let's now reconnect to the economy for the tiny bit of money we need. We no longer need six-figure incomes. We just need a little bit. So it was easy to take the little bit and solve it by just saying, well, we learned to be makers of things. What do we most love making? Mikey picked electronics. I picked botanicals. And we each chose a few things to make and put in a little online store to make up that little difference we needed. So that's today what we do. And I expect that'll change many times throughout our lives, actually.
And we should say that you've gone from six figures to the low five figures. The two of you, about $20,000 a year, you write in the book, is all you need to live on.
Yeah, well, hopefully, knock on wood, we'll hope the book does great. It did reprint on its second week out the door, which was really exciting. But yeah, we'll see. I'm not worried, and I think that's probably a fundamental difference between my life in New York, where I probably had less to worry about because I had this big job. I'm much less worried now because I realize from everything I've been through, the world's really abundant, and the thing that masks it most is commerce. So the more I rely on nature and myself and my creativity, the more I know I'm going to be okay no matter what. So the worry is gone.
Well, that's great. And it's a terrific book. It's The Good Life Lab, Radical Experiments and Hands-On Living. We've been talking with the author and maker, Wendy Jehanara Tremaine. Thanks so much, Wendy, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It was lovely chatting with you.
Wendy Jehanara Tremaine. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Good Life Lab. We've just enough time for a poem that came across my transom this week. It's What the Living Do by Meg Krugman of Sunderland, Massachusetts. Meg happens to be a longtime friend of mine, but it was only recently that I learned what a good poet she is. What the Living Do. It's here again, that sense you're borrowing this supple spine to prop you properly so you can see out of the windows that my eyes become when you are here, inhabited. I feel you lean in from a vaster realm, hair streaming back, star tangled in your rush to flood this doorway. Pour attention on this one bright square of time and place where it just happens now as never there. The window boxes heave with red and blossom yellow. Flight of bird darts like a shuttle through the living loom of green and blue. And my breath's surge becomes your urge to reach out with my hand, take up this pen, and stand once more. Word become flesh in the gallop of wind and sun. That was What the Living Do by Meg Krugman. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.